Welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. Theresa May's government is facing yet another crisis, with a cabinet resignation expected this morning, but not so much this afternoon. I'm Fraser Nelson, and I'm joined by Isabel Hardman and James Forsyth to discuss. Now, James, has just gone midday, and we woke up this morning expecting that number 10 were going to sack Priti Patel for not properly disclosing these various meetings she had with the Israeli government when she was on holiday. Now it seems that Priti Patel's got some dirt on Theresa May and she might stay after all.
Priti Patel was ordered to get on a plane and come back to London. She's currently on the flight.
She left for Uganda yesterday.
Yeah.
And she took an earlier flight, didn't she?
Yes, because so
she could avoid questions.
In this, this story is almost kind of farcical. It starts off with her scurrying off to get an earlier flight at the airport, according to the Daily Telegraph, so that she doesn't have to turn off in the House of Commons and answer the question to her department about her own behaviour. Instead, her deputy goes. And last night, it turned out there were more meetings than the meetings that have been publicly disclosed. At that point, everyone assumed that she was a goner as soon as Theresa May could either reach her on the telephone or see her in person. This morning, though, the Jewish Chronicle have reported that number 10 were aware of some of these meetings and had urged her not to mention them because they were embarrassing, and that while Priti Patel did not seek permission for the meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu, the UK government knew about it within kind of hours of it taking place, which is the opposite of what Alistair Burt told the House of Commons yesterday. Number 10 are now denying the Jewish Chronicle story. But while, as I think this morning, it was completely obvious that Priti Patel was for the high jump, I think it is now not quite so obvious, because it suggests, at the very least, that some people close to her are prepared to basically ensure that if she's going down, some other people are going down with her.
But Isabel, is Theresa May actually strong enough to sack Priti Patel or anybody else from her cabinet? She let go of Michael Fallon last week and did a very quick and rather botched succession of him. But does she have the authority to sort things out right now?
Well, as James says, the list of people who are in trouble has just widened overnight, basically.
I mean, in order of trouble, we've got Priti Patel at number one,
yep.
Probably Boris Johnson in number two.
Yeah, but you've also now got number 10 being dragged in the sense that there are questions about when number 10 knew about certain things, whether that has been made clear in briefings to journalists, for instance, mm-hmm. and whether actually when she was asked to consider her responsibilities, which she was earlier in the week, whether actually number 10 knew more than it had said about her responsibilities.
So we now have Theresa May added to the list of cabinet members in trouble.
Exactly. And the question yesterday was, is Theresa May strong enough to sack one or both out of Priti Patel and Boris Johnson? Mm. And to my mind, she definitely needed to sack one, but actually her sort of caution over sacking Boris Johnson, or even really sort of publicly reprimanding him, because yesterday at the afternoon lobby briefing between number 10 and journalists, the Prime Minister's official spokesman really focused on how it was important now that we had clarity, as opposed to any sense that it was a terrible thing that Johnson had committed this blunder in the first place. Mm. Actually, that, you know, he's not an A-level student. This isn't like, oh, I just retook a module that I got wrong. Mm. He's the Foreign Secretary, and he was at the Foreign Affairs Committee talking about a very sensitive issue. So actually, if Theresa May is still being cautious about sacking cabinet ministers because she's worried about her position, she kind of needs to get real, in that she's doomed anyway. She might as well behave in an authoritative way and try to get as much done and stamp as much discipline on her cabinet as she possibly can, because so many people are plotting against her anyway that I'm not actually sure that the instability that people always talk about of sending someone to the back benches would be quite as dangerous as it seems. It's also very dangerous to give the impression to your cabinet ministers that they can basically do whatever they fancy, whether on holiday or in a select committee, without get away with it.
And James, one of the emerging themes here is that perhaps the root of all this chaos is the absence of any kind of coherent government. You don't have the number 10 communicating to government departments in a way that normally takes place. So when you lift the stone of almost all of these scandals, you see a striking inability
of cabinet members to talk to each other, of a lack of prime ministerial grip, if you like. And I'm beginning to wonder if there are now so many scandals exploding in various places in Whitehall that Theresa May is becoming the net victim of all this, because it's looking as if she's not doing her job of keeping government stable.
Yeah, I mean, this number 10 would be understaffed even in normal times, but it's now having to deal with Brexit, which is the biggest issue any UK government has had to face in peacetime since the war. It's also having to deal with this sex scandal that's going through Westminster that seems to essentially cover everything that has happened between Tory MPs and ministers and anybody else of a sexual nature in the last 15 years, which is quite a long time to look into. And then on top of this, you've got this whole Priti Patel question. I think the other point, though, which is the crucial point Isabel makes this, it is because people think the centre is weak that they are behaving like this. I really don't think when Tony Blair or Margaret Thatcher were in their pomp, ministers would have thought, oh, I'm going on holiday, I'll do a little bit of diplomacy on the side, see how that goes, and won't tell anyone about it. They wouldn't have dared. I think the reason people are daring is because all this is going on. And I am
struck, is it a question of daring, or is it just they're thinking, right, now there, I would like there to be direction for number 10, but there isn't. So if I'm doing my job as a minister, I'm going to have to set my own agenda.
The thing I'm struck by is, I remember at party conference, there was a big story about how Andrew Feldman was raising money for the Amber Rudd campaign.
The former party chairman.
Yes. And there was a big story about how he was raising money for the Amber Rudd campaign. And he told friends, no, I'm not raising money for Amber Rudd. But I have had six cabinet ministers come and talk to me about raising, you know, when the time comes, would they help me raise money? And I think that's incredibly revealing of how many people in the cabinet are thinking, not just thinking beyond Theresa May in the abstract, but down to nuts and bolts of how they would run their leadership campaign after her. And that is because, as Isabel says, no one thinks she is going to lead the Tory party into the next election.
Because, Isabel, what we had thought after the Tory party conference is, yes, she's incredibly weak, but to have a leadership contest now would bring too much stability, it would be too much of a risk. Do you think that calculus is now changing? Do you think that people are looking at Theresa May and thinking she's aiming for stagnation and not even hitting that?
Yeah, I think it's a pretty terrible situation when the government's ambition is for nothing to happen on a day rather than for the government to actually accomplish something by governing. Basically, every decision is now being taken with a view to not causing a row, even if it's actually on something that's quite important, such as, you know, the forthcoming budget. Sometimes you do actually need to cause a row, for instance, on house building or social care. The government doesn't want to do anything that people might notice, I think, it is basically its ambition at the moment. Just on the leadership contest stuff as well, I think there may well be an element of that in what Priti Patel has been up to. Given that she was out there with a member of Conservative Friends of Israel, I wondered whether she felt that was an important constituency to work with in her own campaign for leadership, and in a very clumsy way ended up planning the trip with that in mind as much as anything else.
Do you think she probably went a bit far talking about giving foreign aid money to the Israeli military?
That's probably overstepping the mark. I mean, you could just go to a CFI dinner here, couldn't you?
Yeah, there are easier ways of doing it. But James, I mean, Priti Patel, she's supposed to be in Uganda. It turns out she didn't get to Uganda. I don't know if she went via Ben Gurion or something on the way there. But do you think that we're going to get resolution to this problem today?
I think we will have to, because I think Downing Street need, you know, that old cliched sense, they need an answer by the 6 o'clock news tonight of what is happening.
But she is on her en route as we speak from Nairobi or something.
I think she's meant to land at Heathrow at about 3:30 with the traffic, probably get her to Downing Street for 4:15, 4:30. And then I think the interesting question is what happens? Does Priti Patel just, you know, accept the pearl handed revolver? Or does she say to the Prime Minister, hang on a second, You know, and basically, does she go back to the kind of Jewish Chronicle story, which suggests that number 10 knew way more about this stuff than they're letting on? I mean, this is where things get tricky. And I'd also point to another complication, which is it will be on her mind what happened with Michael Fallon and his resignation, where number 10 suggested to him that they would have a dignified exchange of letters, and that would be that, and nothing else would come out. And then the Andrea Leadsom quotes were plastered all over the papers the next day.
The suspicion being that they were planted by number 10?
Well, what is certain is that the agreement, I don't think Michael Fallon briefed them out, so the agreement was not honoured. And I think this is an interesting question, which is, does Priti Patel think, who is fiercely ambitious, does she think, look, I'm going to do everything I can to try and preserve any ounce of viability I have in a future leadership contest by defending myself as vigorously as possible, rather than just saying, hands up, I'm walking out of the government? Because she's not going to sit there thinking, oh, Theresa May might bring me back in 3 years' time if I behave myself.
Sure, but what is a worse look? To go quietly now, or to inflict damage on the Prime Minister, arguably the party on the way down? Wouldn't that be... I mean, Isabel, what do you think Priti Patel's calculation will be? Because if she does do a j'accuse against Theresa May, saying, OK, sack me if you want, but let the public know that your officials have been lying to journalists about what you knew all week, pretty damaging. Perhaps it might be enough to start serious talk of a leadership challenge again. Now, I'm trying to work out if she would then be seen as the stalking horse who did her party a favour, or somebody who simply inflicted further damage than her original behaviour did in the first place.
I think the Conservative Party more widely in Parliament is still in the place where it is terrified of there being another general election and is very cross with colleagues who are destabilising the government further. But the question is what's more destabilising, sacking Priti Patel or keeping her in? And I'm not sure. I mean, I think Theresa May's opening gambit with her should be, I think you've been working too hard and you could probably do with a proper holiday.
And James, I've had backbenchers and cabinet members who were saying to me emphatically after the Tory party conference meltdown that Theresa May should stay. Those same people are now saying not that she should go, but they are now beginning to change their minds. Do you get a sense that opinion is shifting on
yes.
this issue?
Yes, I think opinion is shifting. I was very struck on Monday. I was calling round among mostly ministers and MPs who'd voted Remain in the referendum, and I was struck by how many of them are basically admitting that things are chipping away, that she's there as the least worst option, but she is becoming a worse option as all of these crises hit. This is why I think what happens with Damien Green is so important, because I think if he has to go, if her effective deputy has to go, the person that she brought into government, and also the person who is basically responsible for making sure that government actually functions, that you don't, that we don't go back to this situation where decisions disappear off into number 10 and are not seen again for 18 months. If he goes, I think a lot of people will begin to think, well, look, maybe the show's over, maybe there is some way. But I think one of the things, again, you come back to this every time, what is the answer? You know, who is the alternative person standing there? Because, you know, you go through the stopgap candidates, you know. Before party conference, it was David Davis. David Davis was then perceived to have had a very bad party conference, and people thought, oh, can't be him. Then people started talking about Michael Fallon. He's obviously now resigned and left the government.
Then Priti Patel, not so much her anymore.
Boris Johnson, you saw Anna Soubry's behaviour towards him yesterday. It is quite clear that there are a sizable number of Tory MPs who would be prepared to do pretty much anything to stop him from making it across the threshold of number 10.
And not just people like Anna Soubry who are recognised as rebels, but those who have got quite a lot of respect more widely.
And Boris is not of a great constituency, does he, Isabel, in the party?
No.
And so
then you come to Amber Rudd. But Amber Rudd, as I say in my politics column magazine tomorrow, recently a former member of David Cameron's number 10 operation went out to find out whether she would run, and the answer came back that she wouldn't throw her hat into the ring until Britain has technically left the EU. So she doesn't think she can be Prime Minister before the 30th of March 2019. Philip Hammond is so loathed in both the cabinet and the Tory backbenches, it's impossible to think of him. So you are beginning to really are exhausting the options. And you look at the reaction to Gavin Williamson, that suggests that the Defence Secretary is not a viable contender here. Damien Green is obviously off the table at the moment. I mean, you are, this is proper head scratching territory. And I think one of the things that this reveals is the problems caused in our politics by the fact that people now want to leave the House of Commons as soon as their ministerial career is over. If William Hague was still in the House of Commons, I think the Tory party would go and bite his hand off and be like, right, there you go, do it. Yeah.
I've actually still heard people talking about how he should go and lead from the House of Lords or something.
It is a disaster for our politics that people basically end their careers as ministers or prime ministers and then think they're going to leave the House of Commons at the very first opportunity. It means there isn't anyone there to act as a kind of stopgap caretaker, which is something that is clearly needed at the moment.
And Isabel, I mean, people often think, how long can this go on for? But John Major's government went on for like less than a very long time. Gordon Brown entered a sense of decay and despair, but staggered on too. Both Brown and Major had opinion ratings far lower than Theresa May's are right now. So there is the prospect of this kind of show of tragicomic errors going on for quite some time.
And we haven't yet got into Cohn hotline territory, so, you know, there's more to come in terms of bizarre announcements from the government to try to redeem itself.
I think one thing which is the problem for when it was announced that that basically this 2-year transition, right, the Brexit transition, some people around Theresa May thought, this is our new argument for why she must stay until 2021. I think part of the problem for her at the moment is how far away all these dates seem. If you just had to get to next March, I think people would just be saying, look, let's just get there. It's going to be a pain. But it's the fact that March 2019 seems such a long way away to people.
December seems a long way away to the Tories right now.
People are struggling to come up with the idea of going through all of that period of time and with a week after week like this. And I think part of the problem is, as Isabel said, the government can't tell a story about itself. What is this government for? And that is the question.
Also, the question we ask in the leading article of the New Spectator, which is published on Thursday. Isabel and James, thanks very much indeed. You can subscribe to this podcast, Coffee House Shots, on the iTunes Store and the magazine itself from just £1 a week on spectator.co.uk/subscribe. You can get a free Moleskine diary as well by using a slightly different URL, spectator.co.uk/pod offer. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Nick Hilton, who produced this podcast.